has been much stronger than among other peoples, and though the impression may easily be created that the intellectual powers of the Jew are at least equal to those of other races, the Jews completely lack the most essential prerequisite of a cultural people, namely, the idealistic spirit. With the Jewish people, the readiness for sacrifice does not extend beyond the simple instinct of individual preservation. In their case, the feeling of racial solidarity which they apparently manifest is nothing but a very primitive, gregarious instinct, similar to that which may be found among other organisms in this world. It is a remarkable fact that this herd instinct brings individuals together for mutual protection only as long as there is a common danger which makes mutual assistance expedient or inevitable. The same pack of wolves which a moment ago joined together in a common attack on their victim will dissolve into individual wolves as soon as their hunger has been satisfied. This is also sure of horses, which unite to defend themselves against any aggressor, but separate the moment the danger is over. It is much the same with the Jew. His spirit of sacrifice is only apparent. It manifests itself only so long as the existence of the individual makes this a matter of absolute necessity. But as soon as the common foe is conquered, and the danger which threatened the individual Jews is overcome, and the prey secured, then the apparent harmony disappears, and the original conditions set in again. Jews act in concord only when a common danger threatens them, or a common prey attracts them. Where these two motives no longer exist, then the most brutal egotism appears, and these people who before had lived together in unity will turn into a swarm of rats that bitterly fight against each other. If the Jews were the only people in the world, they would be wallowing in filth and mire, and would exploit one another and try to exterminate one another in a bitter struggle, except in so far as their utter lack of the ideal of sacrifice, which shows itself in their cowardly spirit, would prevent this struggle from developing. Therefore it would be a complete mistake to interpret the mutual help which the Jews render one another when they have to fight, or, to put it more accurately, to exploit their fellow being, as the expression of a certain idealistic spirit of sacrifice. Here again, the Jew merely follows the call of his individual egotism. That is why the Jewish state, which ought to be a vital organization to serve the purpose of preserving or increasing the race, has absolutely no territorial boundaries. For the territorial delimitation of a state always demands a certain idealism of spirit on the part of the race which forms that state, and especially a proper acceptance of the idea of work. A state which is territorially delimited cannot be established or maintained unless the general attitude towards work be a positive one. If this attitude be lacking, then the necessary basis of a civilization is also lacking. That is why the Jewish people, despite the intellectual powers with which they are apparently endowed, have not a culture, certainly not a culture of their own. The culture which the Jew enjoys today is the product of the work of others, and this product is debased in the hands of the Jew. In order to form a correct judgment of the place which the Jew holds in relation to the whole problem of human civilization, we must bear in mind the essential fact that there never has been any Jewish art, and consequently that nothing of this kind exists today. We must realize that especially in those two royal domains of art, namely architecture and music, the Jew has done no original creative work. When the Jew comes to producing something in the field of art, he merely bowdlerizes something already in existence, or simply steals the intellectual word of others. The Jew essentially lacks those qualities which are characteristic of those creative races that are the founders of civilization. To what extent the Jew appropriates the civilization built up by others, or rather corrupts it, to speak more accurately, is indicated by the fact that he cultivates chiefly the art which calls for the smallest amount of original invention, namely the dramatic art. And even here he is nothing better than a kind of juggler, or perhaps, more correctly speaking, a kind of monkey imitator. For in this domain also he lacks the creative élan which is necessary for the production of all really great work. Even here, therefore, he is not a creative genius, but rather a superficial imitator, who, in spite of all his retouching and tricks, cannot disguise the fact that there is no inner vitality in the shape he gives his products. At this juncture, the Jewish press comes in and renders friendly assistance by shouting hosannas above the head of even the most ordinary bungler of a Jew, until the rest of the world is stampeded into thinking that the object of so much praise must really be an artist, whereas in reality he may be nothing more than a low-class mimic. No, the Jews have not the creative abilities which are necessary to the founding of a civilization, for in them there is not, and never has been, that spirit of idealism which is an absolutely necessary element in the higher development of mankind. Therefore the Jewish intellect will never be constructive, but always destructive. At best, it may serve as a stimulus in rare cases, but only within the meaning of the poet's lines. The power which always wills the bad and always works the good. Kraft, die stets das Böse, will uns stets das Gute schaffen. It is not through his help, but in spite of his help, that mankind makes any progress. Since the Jew has never had a state which was based on territorial delimitations, and therefore never a civilization of his own, the idea arose that we were here dealing with a people who had to be considered as nomads. That is a great and mischievous mistake. The true nomad does actually possess a definite delimited territory where he lives. It is merely that he does not cultivate it, as the settled farmer does, but that he lives on the products of his herds, with which he wanders over his domain. The natural reason for this mode of existence is to be found in the fact that the soil is not fertile, and that it does not give the steady produce which makes a fixed abode possible. Outside of this natural cause, however, there is a more profound cause, namely, that no mechanical civilization is at hand to make up for the natural poverty of the region in question. There are territories where the Aryan can establish fixed settlements by means of the technical skill which he has developed in the course of more than 1,000 years, even though these territories would otherwise have to be abandoned, unless the Aryan were willing to wander about them in nomadic fashion. But his technical tradition and his age-long experience of the use of technical means would probably make the nomadic life unbearable for him. We ought to remember that during the first period of American colonization, numerous Aryans earned their daily livelihood as trappers and hunters, etc., frequently wandering about in large groups with their women and children, their mode of existence very much resembling that of ordinary nomads. The moment, however, that they grew more numerous and were able to accumulate larger resources, they cleared the land and drove out the Aborigines, at the same time establishing settlements which rapidly increased all over the country. The Aryan himself was probably at first a nomad and became a settler in the course of ages. But yet he was never of the Jewish kind. The Jew is not a nomad, for the nomad has already a definite attitude towards the concept of work, and this attitude served as the basis of a later cultural development when the necessary intellectual conditions were at hand. There is a certain amount of idealism in the general attitude of the nomad, even though it be rather primitive. His whole character may, therefore, be foreign to Aryan feeling, but it will never be repulsive. But not even the slightest trace of idealism exists in the Jewish character. The Jew has never been a nomad, but always a parasite, battening on the substance of others. If he occasionally abandoned regions where he had hitherto lived, he did not do it voluntarily. He did it because from time to time he was driven out by people who were tired of having their hospitality abused by such guests. Jewish self-expansion is a parasitic phenomenon, since the Jew is always looking for new pastures for his race.
File 65.
But this has nothing to do with nomadic life as such, because the Jew does not ever think of leaving a territory which he has once occupied. He sticks where he is with such tenacity that he can hardly be driven out even by superior physical force. He expands into new territories only when certain conditions for his existence are provided therein. But even then, unlike the nomad, he will not change his former abode. He is and remains a parasite, a sponger, who, like a pernicious bacillus, spreads over wider and wider areas according as some favourable area attracts him. The effect produced by his presence is also like that of the vampire, for wherever he establishes himself, the people who grant him hospitality are bound to be bled to death sooner or later. Thus the Jew has at all times lived in states that have belonged to other races, and within the organization of those states he had formed a state of his own, which is, however, hidden behind the mask of a religious community, as long as external circumstances do not make it advisable for this community to declare its true nature. As soon as the Jew feels himself sufficiently established in his position to be able to hold it without a disguise, he lifts the mask and suddenly appears in the character which so many did not formerly believe or wish to see, namely, that of the Jew. The life which the Jew lives as a parasite, thriving on the substance of other nations and states, has resulted in developing that specific character which Schopenhauer once described when he spoke of the Jew as the great master of lies. The kind of existence which he leads forces the Jew to the systematic use of falsehood, just as naturally as the inhabitants of northern climates are forced to wear warm clothes. He can live among other nations and states only as long as he succeeds in persuading them that the Jews are not a distinct people, but the representatives of a religious faith, who thus constitute a religious community, though this be of a peculiar character. As a matter of fact, however, this is the first of his great falsehoods. He is obliged to conceal his own particular character and mode of life, that he may be allowed to continue his existence as a parasite among the nations. The greater the intelligence of the individual Jew, the better will he succeed in deceiving others. His success in this line may even go so far that the people who grant him hospitality may be led to believe that the Jew among them is a genuine Frenchman, for instance, or Englishman, or German, or Italian, who just happens to belong to a religious denomination which is different from that prevailing in these countries. Especially in circles concerned with the executive administration of the state, where the officials generally only have a minimum of historical sense, the Jew is able to impose his infamous deception with comparative ease. In these circles, independent thinking is considered a sin against the sacred rules according to which official promotion takes place. It is therefore not surprising that even today in the Bavarian government offices, for example, there is not the slightest suspicion that the Jews form a distinct nation themselves, and are not merely the adherents of a confession, though one glance at the press which belongs to the Jews ought to furnish sufficient evidence to the contrary, even for those who possess only the smallest degree of intelligence. The Jewish Echo, however, is not an official gazette, and therefore not authoritative in the eyes of those government potentates. Jewry has always been a nation of a definite racial character, and never differentiated merely by the fact of belonging to a certain religion. At a very early date, urged on by the desire to make their way in the world, the Jews began to cast about for a means whereby they might distract such attention as might prove inconvenient for them. What could be more effective and at the same time more above suspicion than to borrow and utilize the idea of the religious community? Here also everything is copied, or rather stolen, for the Jew could not possess any religious institution which had developed out of his own consciousness, seeing that he lacks every kind of idealism, which means that belief in a life beyond this terrestrial existence is foreign to him. In the Aryan mind, no religion can ever be imagined unless it embodies the conviction that life in some form or other will continue after death. As a matter of fact, the Talmud is not a book that lays down principles according to which the individual should prepare for the life to come. It only furnishes rules for a practical and convenient life in this world. The religious teaching of the Jews is principally a collection of instructions for maintaining the Jewish blood pure, and for regulating intercourse between Jews and the rest of the world. That is to say, their relation with non-Jews. But the Jewish religious teaching is not concerned with moral problems. It is rather concerned with economic problems, and very petty ones at that. In regard to the moral value of the religious teaching of the Jews, there exist, and always have existed, quite exhaustive studies, not from the Jewish side, for whatever the Jews have written on this question has naturally always been of a tendentious character, which show up the kind of religion that the Jews have in a light that makes it look very uncanny to the Aryan mind. The Jew himself is the best example of the kind of product which this religious training evolves. His life is of this world only, and his mentality is as foreign to the true spirit of Christianity as his character was foreign to the great founder of this new creed 2,000 years ago. And the founder of Christianity made no secret indeed of his estimation of the Jewish people. When he found it necessary, he drove those enemies of the human race out of the temple of God, because then, as always, they used religion as a means of advancing their commercial interests. But at that time, Christ was nailed to the cross for his attitude towards the Jews, whereas our modern Christians enter into party politics, and when elections are being held, they debase themselves to beg for Jewish votes. They even enter into political intrigues with the atheistic Jewish parties against the interests of their own Christian nation. On this first and fundamental lie, the purpose of which is to make people believe that Jewry is not a nation but a religion, other lies are subsequently based. One of those further lies, for example, is in connection with the language spoken by the Jew. For him, language is not an instrument for the expression of his inner thoughts, but rather a means of cloaking them. When talking French, his thoughts are Jewish, and when writing German rhymes, he only gives expression to the character of his own race. As long as the Jew has not succeeded in mastering other peoples, he is forced to speak their language, whether he likes it or not. But the moment that the world would become the slave of the Jew, it would have to learn some other language. Esperanto, for example, so that by this means the Jew could dominate all the more easily. How much the whole existence of this people is based on a permanent falsehood is proved in a unique way by the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which are so violently repudiated by the Jews. With groans and moans, the Frankfurter Zeitung repeats again and again that these are forgeries. This alone is evidence in favour of their authenticity. What many Jews unconsciously wish to do is here clearly set forth. It is not necessary to ask out of what Jewish brain these revelations sprang, but what is of vital interest is that they disclose, with an almost terrifying precision, the mentality and methods of action characteristic of the Jewish people, and these writings expound in all their various directions the final aims towards which the Jews are striving. The study of real happenings, however, is the best way of judging the authenticity of those documents. If the historical developments which have taken place within the last few centuries be studied in the light of this book, we shall understand why the Jewish press necessarily repudiates and denounces it. For the Jewish peril will be stamped out the moment the general public comes into possession of that book and understand it. In order to get to know the Jew properly, it is necessary to study the road which he has been following among the other peoples during the last few centuries. One example will suffice to give a clear insight here. Since his career has been the same at all epochs, just as the people at whose expense he has lived have remained the same, for the purposes of making the requisite analysis, it will be best to mark his progress by stages. For the sake of simplicity, we shall indicate these stages by letters of the alphabet. The first Jews came into what was then called Germania during the period of the Roman invasion, and as usual they came as merchants. During the turmoil caused by the great migrations of the German tribes, the Jews seemed to have disappeared. We may therefore consider the period when the Germans formed the first political communities as the beginning of that process whereby Central and Northern Europe was again, and this time permanently, Judaized. A development began which has always been the same, or similar, wherever and whenever Jews came into contact with Aryan peoples.
File 66.
A. As soon as the first permanent settlements had been established, the Jew was suddenly there. He arrived as a merchant, and in the beginning did not trouble to disguise his nationality. He still remained openly a Jew, partly, it may be, because he knew too little of the language. It may also be that people of other races refused to mix with him, so that he could not very well adopt any other appearance than that of a foreign merchant. Because of his subtlety and cunning, and the lack of experience on the part of the people whose guest he became, it was not to his disadvantage openly to retain his Jewish character. They may even have been advantageous to him, for the foreigner was received kindly. B. Slowly but steadily, he began to take part in the economic life around him. Not as a producer, however, but only as a middleman. His commercial cunning, acquired through thousands of years of negotiation as an intermediary, made him superior in this field to the Aryans, who were still quite ingenuous, and indeed clumsy, and whose honesty was unlimited, so that after a short while commerce seemed destined to become a Jewish monopoly. The Jew began by lending out money at usurious interest, which is a permanent trade of his. It was he who first introduced the payment of interest on borrowed money. The danger which this innovation involved was not at first recognized. Indeed, the innovation was welcomed, because it offered momentary advantages. C. At this stage, the Jew had become firmly settled down. That is to say, he inhabited special sections of the cities and towns, and had his own quarter in the marketplaces. Thus, he gradually came to form a state within a state. He came to look upon the commercial domain and all money transactions as a privilege belonging exclusively to himself, and he exploited it ruthlessly. D. At this stage, finance and trade had become his complete monopoly. Finally, his usurious rate of interest aroused opposition, and the increasing impudence which the Jew began to manifest all round stirred up popular indignation, while his display of wealth gave rise to popular envy. The cup of his iniquity became full to the brim when he included landed property among his commercial wares and degraded the soil to the level of a market commodity. Since he himself never cultivated the soil, but considered it an object to be exploited, on which the peasant may still remain, but only on condition that he submits to the most heartless exactions of his new master, public antipathy against the Jew steadily increased, and finally turned into open animosity. His extortionate tyranny became so unbearable that people rebelled against his control and used physical violence against him. They began to scrutinize this foreigner somewhat more closely, and then began to discover the repulsive traits and characteristics inherent in him, until finally an abyss opened between the Jews and their hosts, across which abyss there could be no further contact. In times of distress, a wave of public anger has usually arisen against the Jew. The masses have taken the law into their own hands. They have seized Jewish property and ruined the Jew in their urge to protect themselves against what they consider to be a scourge of God. Having come to know the Jew intimately through the course of centuries, in times of distress they looked upon his presence among them as a public danger, comparable only to the plague. E. But then the Jew began to reveal his true character. He paid court to governments with servile flattery, used his money to ingratiate himself further, and thus regularly secured for himself once again the privilege of exploiting his victim. Although public wrath flared up against this eternal profiteer and drove him out, after a few years he reappeared in those same places and carried on as before. No persecution could force him to give up his trade of exploiting other people, and no amount of harrying succeeded in driving him out permanently. He always returned after a short time, and it was always the old story with him. In an effort to save at least the worst from happening, legislation was passed which debarred the Jew from obtaining possession of the land. F. In proportion as the powers of kings and princes increased, the Jew sidled up to them. He begged for charters and privileges, which those gentlemen, who were generally in financial straits, gladly granted if they received adequate payment in return. However high the price he has to pay, the Jew will succeed in getting it back within a few years from operating the privilege he has acquired, even with interest and compound interest. He is a real leech who clings to the body of his unfortunate victims and cannot be removed, so that when the princes found themselves in need once again, they took the blood from his swollen veins with their own hands. This game was repeated unendingly. In the case of those who were called German princes, the part they played was quite as contemptible as that played by the Jew. They were a real scourge for their people. Their compeers may be found in some of the government ministers of our time. It was due to the German princes that the German nation could not succeed in definitely freeing itself from the Jewish peril. Unfortunately, the situation did not change at a later period. The princes finally received the reward which they had a thousandfold deserved for all the crimes committed by them against their own people. They had allied themselves with Satan, and later on they discovered that they were in Satan's embrace. G. By permitting themselves to be entangled in the toils of the Jew, the princes prepared their own downfall. The position which they held among their people was slowly but steadily undermined, not only by their continued failure to guard the interests of their subjects, but by the positive exploitation of them. The Jew calculated exactly the time when the downfall of the princes was approaching, and did his best to hasten it. He intensified their financial difficulties by hindering them in the exercise of their duty towards their people, by inveigling them through the most servile flatteries into further personal display, whereby he made himself more and more indispensable to them. His astuteness, or rather his utter unscrupulousness, in money affairs, enabled him to exact new income from the princes, to squeeze the money out of them, and then have it spent as quickly as possible. Every court had its court Jews, as this plague was called, who tortured the innocent victims until they were driven to despair, while at the same time this Jew provided the means which the princes squandered on their own pleasures. It is not to be wondered at that these ornaments of the human race became the recipients of official honours, and were even admitted into the ranks of the hereditary nobility, thus contributing not only to expose that social institution to ridicule, but also to contaminate it from the inside. Naturally, the Jew could now exploit the position to which he had attained and push himself forward even more rapidly than before. Finally, he became baptized, and thus entitled to all the rights and privileges which belonged to the children of the nation on which he preyed. This was a high-class stroke of business for him, and he often availed himself of it to the great joy of the Church, which was proud of having gained a new child in the faith, and also to the joy of Israel, which was happy at seeing the trick pulled off successfully. H. At this stage, a transformation began to take place in the world of Jewry. Up to now, they had been Jews. That is to say, they did not hitherto set any great value on pretending to be something else. And anyhow, the distinctive characteristics which separated them from other races could not be easily overcome. Even as late as the time of Frederick the Great, nobody looked upon the Jews as other than a foreign people. And Goethe rose up in revolt against the failure legally to prohibit marriage between Christians and Jews. Goethe was certainly no reactionary, and no time-server. What he said came from the voice of the blood and the voice of reason. Notwithstanding the disgraceful happenings taking place in court circles, the people recognized instinctively that the Jew was the foreign body in their own flesh, and their attitude towards him was directed by recognition of that fact. But a change was now destined to take place. In the course of more than 1,000 years, the Jew had learned to master the language of his host so thoroughly that he considered he might now lay stress on his Jewish character and emphasize the Germanism a bit more. Though it must have appeared ridiculous and absurd at first sight, he was impudent enough to call himself a Teuton, which in this case meant a German. In that way began one of the most infamous impositions that can be imagined. The Jew did not possess the slightest traces of the German character. He had only acquired the art of twisting the German language to his own uses, and that in a disgusting way, without having assimilated any other feature of the German character. Therefore, his command of the language was the sole ground on which he could pretend to be a German. It is not, however, by the tie of language, but exclusively by the tie of blood, that the members of a race are bound together. And the Jew himself knows this better than any other, seeing that he attaches so little importance to the preservation of his own language, while at the same time he strives his utmost to maintain his blood free from an intermixture with that of other races. A man may acquire and use a new language without much trouble, but it is only his old ideas that he expresses through the new language. His inner nature is not modified thereby. The best proof of this is furnished by the Jew himself. He may speak a thousand tongues, and yet his Jewish nature will remain always one and the same. His distinguishing characteristics were the same when he spoke the Latin language at Ostia 2,000 years ago, as a merchant in grain, as they are today, when he tries to sell adulterated flour with the aid of his German gibberish. He is always the same Jew. That so obvious a fact is not recognized by the average head clerk in a German government department, or by an officer in the police administration, is also a self-evident and natural fact, since it would be difficult to find another class of people who are so lacking in instinct and intelligence as the civil servants employed by our modern German state authorities. The reason why, at the stage I am dealing with, the Jew so suddenly decided to transform himself into a German is not difficult to discover. He felt the power of the princes slowly crumbling, and therefore looked about to find a new social plank on which he might stand. Furthermore, his financial domination over all spheres of economic life had become so powerful that he felt he could no longer sustain that enormous structure, or add to it, unless he were admitted to the full enjoyment of the rights of citizenship. He aimed at both, preservation and expansion, for the higher he could climb, the more alluring became the prospect of reaching the old goal, which was promised to him in ancient times, namely world rulership, and which he now looked forward to with feverish eyes, as he thought he saw it visibly approaching. Therefore all his efforts were now directed to becoming a fully fledged citizen, endowed with all civil and political rights. That was the reason for his emancipation from the ghetto.
File 67.
I. And thus the court Jew slowly developed into the national Jew. But naturally he still remained associated with persons in higher quarters, and he even attempted to push his way further into the inner circles of the ruling set. But at the same time, some other representatives of his race were currying favour with the people. If we remember the crimes the Jew had committed against the masses of the people in the course of so many centuries, how repeatedly and ruthlessly he exploited them, and how he sucked out even the very marrow of their substance. And when we further remember how they gradually came to hate him, and finally considered him as a public scourge, then we may well understand how difficult the Jew must have found this final transformation. Yes, indeed, it must tax all their powers to be able to present themselves as friends of humanity to the poor victims whom they have skinned raw. Therefore, the Jew began by making public amends for the crimes he had committed against the people in the past. He started his metamorphosis by first appearing as the benefactor of humanity. Since his new philanthropic policy had a very concrete aim in view, he could not very well apply to himself the biblical counsel not to allow the left hand to know what the right hand is giving. He felt obliged to let as many people as possible know how deeply the sufferings of the masses grieved him, and to what excesses of personal sacrifice he was ready to go in order to help them. With this manifestation of innate modesty, so typical of the Jew, he trumpeted his virtues before the world, until finally the world actually began to believe him. Those who refused to share this belief were considered to be doing him an injustice. Thus, after a little while, he began to twist things around, so as to make it appear that it was he who had always been wronged, and vice versa. There were really some particularly foolish people who could not help pitying this poor unfortunate creature of a Jew. Attention may be called to the fact that in spite of his proclaimed readiness to make personal sacrifices, the Jew never becomes poor thereby. He has a happy knack of always making both ends meet. Occasionally his benevolence might be compared to the manure which is not spread over the field merely for the purpose of getting rid of it, but rather with a view to future produce. Anyhow, after a comparatively short period of time, the world was given to know that the Jew had become a general benefactor and philanthropist. What a transformation! What is looked upon as more or less natural when done by other people here became an object of astonishment, and even sometimes of admiration, because it was considered so unusual in a Jew. That is why he has received more credit for his acts of benevolence than ordinary mortals. And something more. The Jew became liberal all of a sudden, and began to talk enthusiastically of how human progress must be encouraged. Gradually he assumed the air of being the herald of a new age. Yet at the same time he continued to undermine the groundwork of that part of the economic system in which people have the most practical interest. He bought up stock in the various national undertakings, and thus pushed his influence into the circuit of national production, making this latter an object of buying and selling on the stock exchange, or rather what might be called the pawn in a financial game of chess, and thus ruining the basis on which personal proprietorship alone is possible. Only with the entrance of the Jew did that feeling of estrangement between employers and employees begin, which led at a later date to the political class struggle. Finally, the Jew gained an increasing influence in all economic undertakings by means of his predominance in the stock exchange. If not the ownership, at least he secured control of the working power of the nation. In order to strengthen his political position, he directed his efforts towards removing the barrier of racial and civic discrimination, which had hitherto hindered his advance at every turn. With characteristic tenacity, he championed the cause of religious tolerance for this purpose, and in the Freemason organization, which had fallen completely into his hands, he found a magnificent weapon which helped him to achieve his ends. Government circles, as well as the higher sections of the political and commercial bourgeoisie, fell a prey to his plans through his manipulation of the Masonic net, though they themselves did not even suspect what was happening. Only the people as such, or rather the masses which were just becoming conscious of their own power and were beginning to use it in the fight for their rights and liberties, had hitherto escaped the grip of the Jew. At least his influence had not yet penetrated to the deeper and wider sections of the people. This was unsatisfactory to him. The most important phase of his policy was therefore to secure control over the people. The Jew realized that in his efforts to reach the position of public despot, he would need a peacemaker. And he thought he could find a peacemaker if he could whip in sufficient extensive sections of the bourgeois. But the Freemasons failed to catch the glove manufacturers and the linen weavers in the frail meshes of their net. And so it became necessary to find a grosser, and withal a more effective means. Thus another weapon beside that of the Freemasonry would have to be secured. This was the press. The Jew exercised all his skill and tenacity in getting hold of it. By means of the press, he began gradually to control public life in its entirety. He began to drive it along the road which he had chosen to reach his own ends, for he was now in a position to create and direct that force which, under the name of public opinion, is better known today than it was some decades ago. Simultaneously, the Jew gave himself the air of thirsting after knowledge. He lauded every phase of progress, particularly those phases which led to the ruin of others, for he judges all progress and development from the standpoint of the advantages which these bring to his own people. When it brings him no such advantages, he is the deadly enemy of enlightenment and hates all culture which is real culture as such. All the knowledge which he acquires in the schools of others is exploited by him exclusively in the service of his own race. Even more watchfully than ever before, he now stood guard over his Jewish nationality. Though bubbling over with enlightenment, progress, liberty, humanity, etc., his first care was to preserve the racial integrity of his own people. He occasionally bestowed one of his female members on an influential Christian, but the racial stock of his male descendants was always preserved unmixed, fundamentally. He poisons the blood of others, but preserves his own blood unadulterated. The Jew scarcely ever marries a Christian girl, but the Christian takes a Jewess to wife. The mongrels that are a result of this latter union always declare themselves on the Jewish side. Thus a part of the higher nobility in particular became completely degenerate. The Jew was well aware of this fact, and systematically used this means of disarming the intellectual leaders of the opposite race. To mask his tactics and fool his victims, he talks of the equality of all men, no matter what their race or colour may be. And the simpletons began to believe him. Since his whole nature still retains too foreign an odour for the broad masses of the people to allow themselves to be caught in his snare, he uses the press to put before the public a picture of himself which is entirely untrue to life, but well designed to serve his purpose. In the comic papers, special efforts are made to represent the Jews as an inoffensive little race, which, like all others, has its peculiarities. In spite of their manners, which may seem a bit strange, the comic papers present the Jews as fundamentally good-hearted and honourable. Attempts are generally made to make them appear insignificant rather than dangerous. During this phase of his progress, The chief goal of the Jew was the victory of democracy, or rather the supreme hegemony of the parliamentary system, which embodies his concept of democracy. This institution harmonizes best with his purposes, for thus the personal element is eliminated, and in its place we have the dunder-headed majority, inefficiency, and last, but by no means least, knavery. The final result must necessarily have been the overthrow of the monarchy, which had to happen sooner or later.
File 68.
J. A tremendous economic development transformed the social structure of the nation. The small artisan class slowly disappeared, and the factory worker, who took its place, had scarcely any chance of establishing an independent existence of his own, but sank more and more to the level of a proletariat. An essential characteristic of the factory worker is that he is scarcely ever able to provide for an independent source of livelihood which will support him in later life. In the true sense of the word, he is disinherited. His old age is a misery to him, and can hardly be called life at all. In earlier times, a similar situation had been created, which had imperatively demanded a solution, and for which a solution was found. Side by side with the peasant and the artisan, a new class was gradually developed, namely that of officials and employees, especially those employed in the various services of the state. They also were a disinherited class, in the true sense of the word, but the state found a remedy for this unhealthy situation by taking upon itself the duty of providing for the state official who could establish nothing that would be an independent means of livelihood for himself in his old age. Thus, the system of pensions and retiring allowances was introduced. Private enterprises slowly followed this example in increasing numbers, so that today every permanent non-manual worker receives a pension in his later years, if the firm which he has served is one that has reached or gone beyond a certain size. It was only by virtue of the assurance given of state officials that they would be cared for in their old age that such a high degree of unselfish devotion to duty was developed, which in pre-war times was one of the distinguishing characteristics of German officials. Thus, a whole class which had no personal property was saved from destitution by an intelligent system of provision, and found a place in the social structure of the national community. The problem is now put before the state and nation, but this time in a much larger form. When the new industries sprang up and developed, millions of people left the countryside and the villages to take up employment in the big factories. The conditions under which this new class found itself forced to live were worse than miserable. The more or less mechanical transformation of the methods of work hitherto in vogue among the artisans and peasants, did not fit in well with the habits or mentality of this new working class. The way in which the peasants and artisans had formerly worked had nothing comparable to the intensive labour of the new factory worker. In the old trades, time did not play a highly important role, but it became an essential element in the new industrial system. The formal taking over of the old working hours into the mammoth industrial enterprises had fatal results. The actual amount of work hitherto accomplished within a certain time was comparatively small, because the modern methods of intensive production were then unknown. Therefore, though in the older system a working day of 14 or even 15